Isn't it rich? Are we a pair? Me here at last on the ground, you in midair. Send in the clowns. Isn't it bliss? Don't you approve? One who keeps tearing around, one who can't move. Where are the clowns? Send in the clowns. Just when I'd stopped opening doors, finally knowing the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again with my usual flair. Sure of my line, no one is there.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I am so happy that Lori Moore is here in the studio. Lori, welcome to Living Writers.
Oh, thank you very much.
Welcome back.
Thank you. I haven't heard that Frank Sinatra version of that song in so long. He sings it so well, I forgot.
He does a few good things.
Yeah.
And we've got Jason Voss behind the glass engineering today. And Lori, thanks for choosing the songs for today's program.
I don't really know. I chose a bunch, but I don't know
We'll see
what happens. The Frank Sinatra surprised me. So
when was the last time you heard it?
I think. I heard, the last time I heard that song was probably last year when Glynis Johns died. Do you remember? Glynis Johns was the original person who sang it, and Stephen Sondheim loved her voice because it wasn't a conventional voice. She was a British actress, and she did it for, it's from A Little Night Music. And so they were playing it a lot when she died, Glynis Johns. She was an old woman. It wasn't a horrible tragedy, but she was a wonderful British actress with this quirky voice. You may remember her as the mother in Mary Poppins.
Oh, that was Glynis Johns.
Yes, where she sings, "We're clearly soldiers in petticoats, sister suffragette." But she was the first one to sing that song, I do believe. And then, of course, Judy Collins had a hit with it, and I just haven't, I never listened to the Frank Sinatra that much, so I haven't heard it in a very long time, and he sings it with great feeling. I keep forgetting that about his voice, that he can do that.
His voice is something else.
Yeah, especially that mid-career voice, that's what that is. It's dropping, it's not the higher voice, and at the very end of his career, it was kind of breaking up a little, his voice.
But as everything wears out.
Yeah.
A little bit, doesn't it? Thanks for saying that about Glynis Johns, because some people used to say that my mom's voice reminded them of Glynis Johns. But I think mom, because mom's English, but she never, I think, took it as a compliment. But from what you say, it was a quirky voice, but a good voice, too.
Well, Sondheim loved it. He didn't like having real singers sing his music. He liked people with different kinds of voices to sing. He didn't want professionalized singing in his musicals. So there are you know, so there's some quirky, like, you know, Elaine Stritch, and, you know, there's weird singers. Although he's got some good singers, obviously, like, you know, Dean Jones. But Dean Jones didn't really have a career singing. But he could have, it seems to me, when you hear him sing in Company.
So music is really important to you.
Well, maybe Sondheim.
Really?
Yeah.
Is it the story quality behind that's always present within?
I don't know. I think it's just musical theater. I've always been interested in musical theater, and Sondheim is, you know, I came to very late. You wouldn't be a child going to watch Company, probably. Although probably there are children who do. But his musical theater was for adults. It was for grown-ups. It wasn't like The Lion King or anything like that. It was for grown-ups.
You're here as part of the Zell Visiting Writers Series.
I am.
You're here on campus.
I am.
It's not your first rodeo. I mean, and it's also not your first time on campus. You also were teaching in the MFA program here.
Long ago. Yeah, probably like 27 years ago.
Time goes by.
Long time. Yeah.
And it's so good to have you back on campus.
Well, thank you. And thank you for welcoming me back.
And we've got your book on the table with us. It's your latest novel, I Am Homeless If This Is Not My Home, out with Vintage Books in 2024, but was out in hardcover in 2023. And this book... I'm so excited to talk with you.
Really?
About it.
Okay.
Are you tired of it now? Well, not
no,
tired.
No.
Oh my God! I can't even. That good way to start. Are you tired of this book, Glory Moore?
No, I'm really. I'm not. I mean, a lot of people have questions about it, and I'm perfectly happy to answer it. I mean, it's not a book for everyone. Not everyone really gets this book, and that's fine, and I knew that when I was writing it.
And you say that, and yet also it's got one of these winner stickers on it. National Book Critics Circle... Wait, I always mess this one up. National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction.
I know. That was sort of amazing. Yeah. Yeah.
But you say it's not for everyone, and you're a bit shy, it seems like, to show people at first this book.
Oh, yeah. Well, I didn't show it to anyone until I gave it to my agent and then she gave it to my editor. And I remember saying this to Jane Smiley. I said, if I can get this book past my agent and my editor, I think it will find some readers. And she said, I know exactly what you mean. I had the same feeling with Paris Perestroika. Now, I had not read that novel. And so I went and looked at it. And it's from the point of view of a horse. It's a talking horse.
That makes sense for Jane Smiley.
Of course.
That totally is,
of course,
like the book she's meant to write in
right,
many ways. Yeah.
Right. Well, so I thought, well, if she can... write a novel from the point of view of a horse, maybe I'll be okay.
I think so.
Yeah.
And when you were writing it, did it feel, you know, did it feel necessary in the writing, or did you feel like it was something was transgressive in the writing of it where you were, that's why you wondered about it? Like you were like, well, this book isn't for everyone.
I didn't want to have to explain it while I was writing it. I knew, so I just didn't show it to anyone. And I'm never one to show my work very often anyway, although I think it's a good idea in general for writers to do that. And I have done it in the past, you know, just one or two people showing your work to them and taking in their responses. And everybody's responses are always different, which is helpful, you know, getting different responses. I would have to explain too much, and I just thought, I'm going to wait till I'm done, and then I'll answer people's questions.
And fair enough, really, because it feels like you wanted to see what it would become, too.
Well, I knew it had this bicameral aspect, that it had these two, that part of it was taking place via letters in the 19th century, and the other part was taking place in 2016. And going back and forth between that, you don't quite get the hinge, what's connecting these things, until later in the book. Yeah.
And that's great that you trusted your readers to get there.
Yeah. I mean, it can be annoying, I know, when you have a bicameral thing and you say, why did the author put these two separate, distinct narratives together and you know, make you go back and forth between them when they don't seem to have that much in common? But eventually, you know, they have enough in common. Enough, I think. And they're, you know, they have bookbinding glue in common.
and there's... Because it feels like one of the stories, in a way, is also a ghost story. Like, the letters are part of, like, it feels like it's a presence, another presence.
Both sections are about people trying to commune with the dead, in a way. Yeah.
And why do you think that was something your writing consciousness was interested in as you were writing this book?
Yeah, I think so many people had started to die. You know, you get older and suddenly there's as many people who have died as, you know, on the other side as there are, you know, living with you in your life. And you just think, well, part of my life is happening in the afterlife. And so you try to sort of, you wonder about that. And you can imagine trying to sort of continue conversations with people. And sometimes you've probably had this experience where you sometimes think you see someone. You go, oh, but it's not that person. But you think you see them. And I remember having a friend who died, and I wanted to see if his email address still worked. And I wrote him an email, and I said, hi, I'm thinking of you. How are you doing? And I pressed send. And it didn't come back, but his wife wrote me back and said, oh, I do this all the time. So she does it all the time.
She was emailing him as well.
Yeah, she said that, you know.
That's really lovely.
Yeah. Yeah. You still carry on conversations with people who have died, but in some ways it just seems like they're on a very long trip to Australia.
It's like it's on a boat.
Yeah, or they're just, yeah, there's, they, yeah.
And because I think, I like that you took it to like the physical, well, I guess the technological world, instead of like having the conversations in your mind or talking out loud by walking along like the Atlantic or something, you know, you thought, oh, I'm going to.
Well, there, you know, there the email, what his address was there, and, you know, and all these old email messages that you, and correspondences that you keep are all there in your inbox, and you just sometimes want to experiment.
And try again.
See if they work. And just wonder where they go, you know.
That's true. I think one of our good friends here at the station, who a longtime DJ and community member, Tex, Jim Mannheim, just died recently. And,
oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, it's so hard.
Thanks, Laurie. But it's like he had sent an email from across the world, and only in September. And so it's just strange to see it there, mm-hmm. you know, not so long ago.
I think the finality of death is too difficult, and maybe not that true. I mean, at least as we experience it, because we keep people alive in all kinds of ways, you know, memories and conversations, and you know. So the book starts off with a woman who's writing her deceased sister, and she keeps that conversation going, and you learn about her through those letters, and then the 2016 part of the book is about a man whose brother is dying and whose ex-girlfriend has died. So, but he has contact with both of them.
Let's take a short break and then we'll come back. Today on Living Writers, Lori Moore is here in the studio. The book on the table with us, I Am Homeless If This Is Not My Home. Lori Moore is in town, I should say, with the Zell Visiting Writers Series. You can hear Lori Moore at UMA for a reading tomorrow. And then on Friday, there's a craft talk. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Jason behind the glass. We'll be back. Back. If you're just tuning in, I'm so glad you did. Today on Living Writers, Lori Moore is here, and we were just having a bit of a good old cry there with Moon River. Thanks to JAV for playing that version of the song. And Lori, it's in I am homeless if this is not my home. Mm-hmm. How does Moon River like figure in as like a presence?
I have completely forgotten.
No. Okay.
I think they're he's driving along, and I don't know. I think
because they're in Kentucky.
Yeah, they're driving a lot at night. They're looking at the moon and looking at the stars.
Finn and his ex-girlfriend Lily.
Yeah, and somehow I think various songs come up. Yeah.
And that song just, it is. It's again, it's another one of those songs that you just, yeah, you can't help but feel.
Yeah. I wonder, I can't remember how Frank Sinatra sings that song, but I suspect he doesn't have that chorus in the background, probably.
Oh, no. Is that the part that for you, you're like, oh, this brings a little levity into
yes.
it?
Yes. Yes.
Well, you know, right before the break, we were talking about, you were talking about some of the structure, like how this novel is put together. Would you mind reading a section, Lori, like a couple of pages? Do you like some free form reading for us?
Okay.
Here?
Should I read from the contemporary part?
What do you feel like reading today?
I didn't prepare. So you know what? I'll just read from the beginning of the part that's set in New York. It begins in New York, and because Finn is visiting his brother, who is in New York, having in hospice in New York in 2016. So I'll just read for how long? Just a page or two? Okay. Korean griddle grease and the smoke from late morning weed in the air, winds light and variable, the sweet stink of sun-warmed trash bags. This was the Indian summer the Algonquins had wanted to be rid of and succeeded, absconding with their jewels and hilarity. The vibrating scorch and scotch of the subway, sulfurous sewage exhaled from the hard open mouth of the Broadway local, block after block of brick and concrete buildings, some roaring, some asleep, encaged in geometric jungles of scaffolding. Traffic rumbled like a sea. Ambulances practiced their glissandos. Authority was the merchandise as well as the port. Authority, in quotation marks, was everybody's brand. Vespas sped by, seemingly without riders. Finn got the young attendant to retrieve the car from the garage early, from the early bird special. While waiting, he noticed a bicycle rickshaw slowing in front of him. Its driver resembled Pete Seeger, replete with a neat wool cap, a flannel shirt, suspenders, but instead of crooning, turn, 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 he was screaming, watch, 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 at the top of his lungs. Watch out for the instructions under the hood. Don't think they're not there. Be afraid of the silver ladies and the pink wires and the shoes, the shoes, the shoes. The white schizophrenics were allowed to ride bikes here. The black schizophrenics huddled under blankets and cardboard on sidewalks against the facades of the skyscrapers. Pieces of paper rolled into jars with scrawled writing faced outward. I am not homeless. This is my home. Hey, the man running the food cart on the corner of 28th shouted at Pete Seeger, the bike cabbie. Dude, you need a burrito. Then the bike cabbie drove away. The Chelsea cookware bombs had happened 1 month before. People were both moving on and not. Should I stop there? Okay. People don't remember those Chelsea cookware bombs. Someone asked me about that. Like, what was that? But that was a... do you remember that? Oh, there were bombs that were left on the street.
In the 80s?
No, this was in 2016.
Oh, it wasn't in the fall. In the time of 2016. Okay.
Oh, yeah. It was in September, I think, of 2016. They tried to have the bombs work, but the bombs didn't quite work. But they were discovered in cookware that had been left on the street to go off and to ignite. So it was attempted terrorism. It wasn't successful.
Was it meant to be somehow around, like, in the election, or just it was someone's individual?
I don't think it had that much to do with the election. I think it had just more to do with ongoing terrorism.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ongoing. Thanks for choosing to read that section, because I had already forgotten a couple of things from that opening, because we could have had, like, thinking about how music is part of this book, Pete Seeger is on page one with Turn, Turn, and then it's turned into a different song as well, and meaning for who this Seeger is. And also, the title of the book is also nested within those.
Yeah.
Was that intentional,
Lori? Oh, sure. Yeah. The title was the working title of the book as I was working on it, and I really intended it to be a little more about Lily and how she didn't, I mean, because it is about someone grappling with the mysteries of suicide. And so this is a sense of not belonging anywhere that she has, and that is part of her particular despair. But it's also an existential condition for a couple of other characters, too. And then, of course, you have just other people on the street who have the same idea, sort of. Except the homeless person says, "This, I'm not homeless. This is my home."
Yeah, claiming it.
Claiming it, right. Because he doesn't want to be and rounded up.
I'm sorry?
He doesn't want to be rounded up.
Yeah. And I feel like the title, "I Am Homeless If This Is Not My Home," to me it feels positive, too. It feels that it means, like, this is what we have. This is a time to be, and this is where we can be.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly one way of looking at it. I also thought it sounded a little bit like a folk song.
It doesn't.
And I had to Google it to make sure it wasn't already taken as the title of a folk song. But
there's a challenge for folk singers out there. Put this into a song.
Could, yeah, it's, you're welcome to it.
And was it always not capitalized too?
No, that's just a fluke of
design.
Yeah, that's just a design thing. I think if you see the hardcover, it's capitalized.
Oh, okay.
They just did it this way for the paperback. I don't know why anyone does anything in publishing. So, it was just a design. I think the paperback graphic designers like lowercase for some reason. I don't know. It is a little heavy. I mean, it's kind of a heavy title, so maybe they were trying to lighten it up or just keep it from being blocky by putting it all in lowercase. I can sort of see that.
Yeah. I'm going to have to look at the hardcover, too, now.
Yeah.
I'm curious.
Yeah.
I'll have to Google it.
Yeah.
Everyone out there. Earlier, Lori, you said there was only, like, maybe a couple of people that you trust to read your early drafts. And is one of them your long-term agent? Is that?
Oh, she is. She is always there eventually. I mean, I don't show her drafts. I show her the finished thing.
How did you find each other, Lori? Because it feels like to have this kind of a relationship with someone, it feels almost like in a different way, like you said, like not an editor, but someone who knows you and your work over years.
Well, yeah, she's just been my agent, you know, since I was 26. So how old am I now? So we're talking about 42 years. Yeah, so, I mean, we both were young when we started, and now we're not so young. But, yeah, we just, you know, we've had this long professional relationship, and I had a long professional relationship with my editor at Knopf, Vicki Wilson, who then retired a year ago.
Oh, okay.
And so I now have a different editor at Knopf, but I don't have a book out. So it's, you know, neither here nor there.
But you're working on one.
I'm always working on something. Yeah, I'm always working on things.
Is this next book by Cameral as well?
No, I don't think so. You look very happy.
Oh, no, no, I'm just happy to talk with you. You could say anything and I'd be like, oh, really?
Yeah, no, I don't have the structure. Now that you mention it, maybe it does have sections, and I don't know. I don't, we'll see.
Do you feel like the next book is, like,
I feel like the
free,
next book is,
like, as this book could be, like, because this feels like you felt like I can do anything, like Jim Morrison, I'm the Lizard King or so.
Well, you want to feel that, and you also want to feel a sense of purpose. So, I mean, you have both. You want to feel free and purposeful. But, you know, right now I'm teaching. And it's hard to write and teach at the same time. So, we'll see.
That's kind of the same energy, like the same headspace use.
I don't know. It's just the same time space. You know, it's just the time. It's just time and energy. It's not really the same headspace, which I suppose is good.
Right, that, yeah.
It's a little different, the headspace, but the time and energy are from the same source, yeah.
Do you miss it then if you're not writing?
Oh, totally, yeah. But sometimes I miss teaching when I'm not teaching. So, you know...
It's good to have both.
It is good to have both. And if you can get your life structured so you can have both, which has been the trick my entire life that I have not been able to sort of manage. But I think it's easier to manage when you're younger because you just have more time and more energy. But we'll see. We'll see. I have some, you know, we'll see.
There's time.
Yeah.
There's time.
Yeah.
Speaking of time, we'll take a short break.
Oh.
And then we'll come back. Okay. Today on Living Writers, Lori Moore is here in person. The last time Lori Moore was on Living Writers, it was via phone in 2009 for your novel, A Gate in the Stairs.
Right.
It's so good to see you in person.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
Friend of the show, Lori Moore. Okay, we'll take a short break and we'll be right back.
Make me over. Now that you know how I adore you. Don't pick on the things I say, the things I do. Just love me with all my faults, the way that I love you. I'm begging you. Don't make me over. Make me over. I wouldn't change one thing about you. Just take me inside your arms and hold me tight and always be by my side. If I am wrong or right, I'm begging you.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're just in time for some Living Writers today with Lori Moore. Her novel, I Am Homeless If This Is Not My Home. Lori Moore is in town right now as part of the Zell Visiting Writers series. Lori, you'll be at UMA tomorrow giving a reading. And will you be reading from I Am Homeless? Or will you? Or
I don't know. I
short
don't.
Stories or
I bark? I might read a short story.
I might.
I don't know. We'll see.
How do you decide what you're going to?
I don't know.
You just see. Okay.
We'll see.
Get off the subject. And then you have a craft talk on Friday morning.
Right.
What is the craft talk on this time around, Lori?
I don't have any idea.
Okay. Okay. But I mean, whatever it is, it's
well,
going to be
it's
good.
My thoughts about showing and telling and Wuthering Heights. Because I became obsessed with Wuthering Heights recently.
Did you just reread it?
Oh, yeah. I read it a couple times. It's really weird. It's a very weird book. Then I became obsessed with Emily Bronte and then all the Brontes.
Mm-hmm.
I had been very interested in Charlotte Bronte for a long time, but I really hadn't branched out into the other Brontes. And Daphne du Maurier wrote a biography of Branwell, the brother.
The brother? I did not know that. I just always loved Daphne du Maurier because of Cornwall.
Yeah. And she, of course, she wrote Rebecca, which is a bounce off of Jane Eyre. It's real.
Oh, right.
Right. Some people think it's a steal. It's not really a steal. It's just a bounce.
It's not a steal. I mean, then no one paint anything again either.
Right. No. I mean, unless you find steal a neutral word, which you can. You know, there's that old expression, you know, second-rate artists borrow, first-rate artists steal.
Oh. Uh-huh.
But it's a bounce off Jane Eyre. And the movie is quite different from, the ending of the movie is different from the end of the book. She stays, you know, he's murdered his wife and she stays with him. In Rebecca. At any rate, Daphne du Maurier, who also, I mean, I just taught the birds and then looked at the film. But the birds, people don't realize what a great story writer she was. And the birds is a great short story. It's great speculative fiction. It's not even really speculative. It's sort of eco-fiction, but it's also about the trauma of the war, looking up at the sky and seeing incoming.
Right.
And she wrote it in the late 40s. Mm-hmm. And instead of actual planes and boats, there's birds in the sky, birds coming in from the ocean as well. So,
right, because they're literally on a boat.
Right.
When one of the first birds dive bombs.
Well, that's in the film.
Oh, that's in the film, right.
The film is all shot in California, and the story takes place in England in the late 40s.
I've never read the story.
No one has.
I didn't even know it was a story.
No,
I only know it as Hitchcock's film.
Right. She didn't like Hitchcock's film because it takes tremendous liberties. Mm. But it's an interesting film in its own right, but the story is an amazingly great story.
I'm going to read it now.
Yeah, and it's not that long, and it's really powerful. She's got a couple of weird ones, you know. She's got Don't Look Now, which is sort of a weird story that doesn't quite work, but the film that Nicholas Roeg made from it is beautiful, and she loved that film.
It's interesting how some writers, then filmmakers, are gravitate towards using their work. They can see it cinematographically. I don't know, more easily.
Yeah, I mean, I think she saw, because Hitchcock did Rebecca. So, and I think she liked that, even though the ending was different. And so then she was fine with him doing the birds, but then she wasn't that pleased. But Nicholas Roeg's Don't Look Now, have you seen it recently?
No.
It really holds up. It's really, really great.
I'm writing it down.
Okay.
But Wuthering Heights, have you ever heard the Kate Bush song, Wuthering Heights?
Sure.
Don't you love, from the 80s?
Yep. Yeah.
Did you love it then, too?
Did I love that song, or did I love the book?
The song.
No. I like Kate Bush. But that song, I maybe have to listen to it again, but I thought it was stupid.
You have to get...
I don't know. It's all about, you know, I don't know. It's not the part of Wuthering Heights that I find most interesting.
What is the part?
Well, I think that the struggle of Heathcliff to remake himself in revenge. I mean, it's like The Great Gatsby. And people often will say, oh, yeah, Fitzgerald took his plot from Wuthering Heights, which is sort of true. Except that Wuthering Heights has two generations in it, and so it's also about trauma and embedded trauma. It's really a weird and violent book.
It is.
Yeah.
It's bizarre. That was one that I had to read in high school.
Why they assigned this in high school, I don't know. I think it's too complex formally, and I think it's just, I don't know. I don't think it has anything that high schoolers would understand.
I just thought on Sunday, I want to read that book again.
Mm. There are many, many films that have been made of it. And none of them can get it right because the book is too weird, I think. But there's another film coming out. Margot Robbie is producing a film and starring in it, coming out this winter. But there have been about, I don't know, a dozen films.
That's an interesting... I wonder what she'll do with it.
I have no idea. I have no idea.
We'll have to stay tuned with that. I mean, because I'm thinking about, would you, when you're writing, Lori, do you ever see things like you would cinematically? Would you, when Finn and Lily are driving in the car, for example, there's things that, like the reality being blurred. It would be interesting to see how you visualize it. Is it because it might be through Finn's eyes?
Yeah, I don't. I would be fine if anyone was interested in making it into a film. I kind of see it as more as an opera. I could
how
see
so?
It as an opera because there's a lot of sort of arias and melodramatic moments and a lot of death and darkness, and I think it could work on the stage.
Yes.
And then you could put music, you know, but you'd have to have someone write music for it. And who wants to do that? That's really hard work.
Probably a lot of people, Lori.
I don't know.
We'll see. Any listeners out there?
Any listeners out there? That's right.
That's right. Let's take a short break, okay. And then we'll be back.
All right.
Today on Living Writers, Lori Moore is here, her novel on the table with us. I am homeless if this is not my home. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back.
You had a temper.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel today. Lori Moore is here in the studio. The novel, I Am Homeless If This Is Not My Home. We just got to hear a little bit of Kate Bush, Wuthering Heights. And it got us talking here about the elements of ghost story and love story that that are present here in I Am Homeless If This Is Not My Home.
Right. I did think, you know, that at least the contemporary part, the 2016 part, is a love story in a way, and that every love story needs an obstacle, and the obstacle for these two people is that one of them is dead. So can he triumph over that? He kind of does and kind of doesn't, sort of like Heathcliff. You know, the obstacle is Kathy's died, but she comes back to haunt him. And, yeah. And it's that can never really work in practical terms, but it works for, you know, in emotional terms for a little while. And people get to sort of, you know, at least in this book, Finn gets to revisit some things and they have their conversations in the car and they, you know, they wrap things up. Mm-hmm. But
in doing so, he misses the death of his brother.
That's right.
Max.
That's right. That's right.
That's the hardest part of the book for me.
Well, that's the part where you're supposed to get very angry at Lily. And she and he does, because he does, yeah, he does. But it also helps express that anger that he would have, that she would have caused this particular thing to happen, that he would have missed his brother's death.
You write such beautiful lines, Lori, where you're noting, you're discovering things that, you know, you feel like you're being pulled to do something that you need to do, but that doesn't need you. So you're missed at something, like, and then feeling like you're failing in your own life.
Right. And Finn invents a lot of things, and he has a lot of denial about things. I think he thinks his brother is going to live a long time. And that's what
he's got good insurance.
He's got good insurance, right. And so usually at a hospice, your insurance is like 2 weeks long or something. You're up and out. But he's got good insurance, and so he feels that maybe that will protect him. And he also thinks that the World Series will keep him alive.
Yeah.
Because the World Series is going, and he's really, and it does seem to keep him alive a little bit.
And he buys Max a Cleveland hat.
Yeah, they're kind of conflicted about Cleveland and
the Cubs.
Chicago.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. It's so if you have a love story and you have an obstacle, and the obstacle's death. Then you just tell that story. I mean, sometimes the obstacles can be, as in Wuthering Heights, although it eventually gets to death as an obstacle. The original obstacle is money.
Yeah, class difference.
Class, money, race, trauma. And here, probably the initial obstacle is mental illness, of, you know, her mental illness.
Because that's why we started today with Send in the Clowns. Because Lillian's...
Right. She is a clown.
And she does laugh therapy.
Yeah, yeah. And she, as she says, you know, as when he kind of goads her and says, well, this is what you do for a living. You try to make people happy, try to make them laugh. She said, I guess I just sucked at it. So Can we say that on the air?
I'm not sure.
Maybe they'll believe me.
Yeah. Jason is not. We'll go out with a bang. There's this lovely phrase on that I made a note of. There's just so many. You're going to bury yourself under a full moon with it, like with its Buster Keaton face. I think Finn says that at some point to Lily, like this. Like these moments that you come up with.
Well, the moon sort of does have that Buster Keaton face. Have you? A little bit. It does. A full moon does. Yeah.
And so expressive.
Yeah. And appropriate for someone who, you know, worked as a therapy clown.
A therapy clown. That's why I just loved it. And these moments of like where I just feel like you're so close in with like the hospice and the untouched plastic bottle of Ensure, popsicle melted, these moments. It's for you, was it working out? That's not what I wanted to say at all. But when you're writing, if you are in grief, is it something that by distancing, by creating these characters, are you able to be in your own grief in a way and writing?
I don't feel it quite like that because it's so parallel and so, and in being parallel to whatever grief you have in your own life, it doesn't quite touch. You know, that is the definition of something that's parallel, doesn't intersect. And so, but it runs alongside it. And so there is a way in which, you know, thinking about the people you've lost and then creating a story about people who lose people, it runs alongside your own feelings and your own story. It's not cathartic. And it invents a whole bunch of things that are new and different. Because it has to be in order for you to be interested in it.
And invention.
And for it to have life. If you were just transcribing from your own biography, it wouldn't have life.
Yeah, there would be this. Well, I mean, some people would probably argue, some writers might argue that. But like for how what you're interested in making, it wouldn't have life.
Yeah, it wouldn't have new life at any rate. I mean, if you're transcribing from something that already happened, you probably do risk a little bit of, you know, a recycled feeling. You could risk that. I mean, I don't write nonfiction really in that way, not narrative nonfiction, but people who are really good at it maybe can bring a lot of life to it. And probably people get in trouble for making things up and calling it nonfiction, but I'll bet they have to make up a few things like dialogue they can't quite remember and things like that in order for it to come to life.
Yes. Oh, completely.
Because fiction does, you know, it's giving new life to something. Yeah.
Do you ever miss the short story when you're in like the time of the novel?
Sometimes, but sometimes I get ideas for short stories and I just stop with the novel temporarily and write a short story. You have to do that because short stories are a little more demanding. I mean, they're demanding in a different way. They need to be written right away.
Intensely.
Yeah, they have a certain urgency to them, whereas the novel's just going to be sitting there for a long, long time. It'll be there when you're done, and you'll go back to it like a job. So,
Lori Moore, this has just been so lovely. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me. So great.
anytime. Seriously.
Okay.
Today on Living Writers, Lori Moore, I am homeless if this is not my home. You can see Lori Moore at UMA tomorrow for her reading, and on Friday for the Craft Talk with the Zell Visiting Writers series. Thanks to Jason for engineering. Thanks so much for all of you out there listening, and to Mom listening. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
The environment in the new century, all now. Danger. Ethnic digestion tabernacles, all now. Privacy robotic doubles, rolling rehab threat machines, reformulators, heightened insensitivity vehicles, erotic invisible empires, all now.
Aquified sonic tribulators, on now. Polytonal syntactic demulsifiers, on now. WCBN-FM Ann Arbor, on now.
Here's the report from the world of sports on WCBN.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Daily Sports Report. My name is Zach Warshaw, and on WCBN Sports, I got a full panel for you guys. Actually, not a full panel. I just lied to your face. But it is Hockey Wednesday. I've got Max Wood and Charlie Mitchell back with me again, and we're joined by newcomer Bowen Dang to bring his expertise to this hockey panel we got going on. So, same as last week, we're going to start with a recap of the Michigan hockey result against Western, and then looking ahead to Notre Dame, and then move into mostly NHL this week. So first of all, first game in Ann Arbor, Michigan absolutely just took Western behind the woodshed. Again, this is number two versus number three, so very great matchup, but they just outplayed them on every angle. So we'll start with covering the first one. 4-0 victory. What did you guys see from that? I know Charlie and Bowen, you guys were much more into that one the second game. What were your takes?
I mean, I think the most impressive part was Michigan had six penalties that game, killed six power plays. I think that's a recipe for success so far this year, and I can't really speak for the other game. Unfortunately, I was not able to watch that, but very impressive outing from the penalty kill unit on last Thursday.
Yeah, not much to say. I think the team just exceeded expectations in many ways, in a lot of ways imaginable. And if correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Western Michigan won the national championship last season. So yeah, very impressive showing on the road against the defending national championship.
Well, and as you just said, at this point, the Michigan power play is second in the country. They're capitalizing on 40%.